All right, so that allows me then to move to another pharmacological drug group, the anticonvulsants. Now, there are overlaps between different CNS drug groups. We already can see that because you've just been talking about, or we've just been talking about, GABA and therefore the actions of drugs that work through GABA, which do include benzodiazepines and barbiturates. And certainly this is a mechanism of action that has great relevance to decrease in neuronal activity. I mean, if you can increase inhibition by helping out GABA, then obviously it's more difficult for neurons to fire spontaneously or to, generate a pattern of excessive neuronal activity. That's certainly one way to do it. If you were to block sodium channels involved in axonal conduction, that would be another mechanism of an anticonvulsant drug action, and we have several of our very important anticonvulsants that are very good at doing that. I'm thinking particularly of drugs like phenytoin and carbamazepine in that arena, but other drugs can do that as well. Remember, we just said that the barbiturates, higher doses, probably block sodium channels as well. So, there's clearly the possibility of that as a mechanism of anticonvulsant action. And of course, we also have the possibility selectively of effects on calcium ion channels. Two of our most important drugs used in absence seizures, valproic acid and ethosuximide, appear to decrease the voltage-dependent passage of calcium into neurons present in our thalami. They're actually working on type T channels, which are fairly rare in the periphery, but certainly fairly well known in thalamic neurons. The T is not for thalamus, but it might help you remember it anyway. The T is really for the kinetics, a transient kinetics of opening of that calcium channel. So we've got three mechanisms that seem to involve, movement of ions. If you can help out chloride going in, that's not a bad idea, and benzodiazepines and barbiturates do that. If you can stop sodium going in, that sounds right too. And if you can stop calcium going in presynaptically, that seems to be a useful property as well. Another way we can think about things is, what about if we got in the way of an excitatory transmitter? Would that have any value? Yes, it ought to. In fact, we know that some newer anticonvulsant drugs, most notably lamotrigine and topiramate, and to some extent felbamate, seem to get in the way of the excitatory transmitter glutamic acid. This is going to become more important, obviously, but the trouble with glutamate in terms of it being a target for drugs is that, as I said, over half of our neurons have receptors for glutamic acid. That makes life a little bit difficult in getting selective actions. However, most anticonvulsant drugs are not very selective. I mean, they'll work pretty much anywhere where there's an ion channel there, and that you may have to put up with. All right, now, having some idea of the mechanism of action, I'll tell you that that's sort of important. I think it is important, but it's nowhere near as important as knowing which drug for which seizure disorder. This is an area, by the way, where one would be expected to know which drug would be perhaps a drug of choice and which drug might be a backup drug in terms of individual seizure states. So the table here shows us a reasonable classification of seizure types, although seizure types, as you may be aware, often have components of more than one of these different types. And the drugs of choice are listed, and the backup drugs are listed as well. We can go through this very, very quickly. Partial seizures, whether they're simple or complex, there are three drugs that come to the fore: valproate, phenytoin, and carbamazepine. And those three drugs are fairly interchangeable as drugs of choice. Sometimes more than one of them may be used. About 3 or 4 years ago, phenobarbital was demoted from being a drug of choice. I don't know whether the word demoted is correct, but anyway, is no longer a drug of first choice in terms of those types of seizures. But it would be perhaps the first drug to consider as a backup drug, and probably the first drug to consider for such seizures if the patient was pregnant. And the reason for that is that valproic acid, phenytoin, and carbamazepine are teratogenic. So they cannot be used or should not be used in a pregnant patient. So if you have a pregnant patient who's got a partial seizure, phenobarb has to be the number one drug, right? Even though it's traditionally now thought, well, not traditionally, it's now categorized as an important backup drug, put it in that category. Now, most of the newer drugs that have come into medicine in the past 5 or 6 years for the treatment of seizure disorders also seem to be effective in partial, simple or complex seizures. That's not necessary to say that you would immediately jump into using them. Most newer drugs you've got to be very circumspect about, because you find as time goes by that there's something wrong with them. And so you don't want to be the first on your block, as it were, to be responsible for an adverse effect. And I would say that they would be backup drugs. What about general tonic-clonic seizures? This was the old grand mal. Now, you don't have to worry too much there, because you got the same drug groups here, that are first choice, as you had for the partial seizures. Valproic acid, phenytoin, and carbamazepine. That's nice, because it's easier in terms of memory. It's nice to know that phenobarb is the first backup drug in this regard, and some of the newer drugs also can be effective in tonic-clonic seizures. Things get a little bit simpler from here on out. Absence seizures. Now, absence seizures, of course, are the seizures that we generally think of in childhood or early adulthood, where we have these rather transient, generally, seizures that, you know, take people away from, you know, their conscious surroundings, maybe as many as 50, 60, 100 times a day. They certainly cause dysfunction, and one of the big problems in children, of course, is it interferes with their attention, it interferes with their ability to learn, etc. As far as the drug of choice, the drug of choice really varies between valproic acid and ethosuximide. It's been interchangeable lately because a lot of young people, or anybody for that matter, get gastrointestinal distress from ethosuximide. It's an incidence of somewhere over 40% of quite severe GI distress. So a lot of people now think that valproic acid is the best bet there. But either of them are fairly suitable for treatment of this type of disorder. Trouble with valproate, of course, is twofold, as we'll see in a moment. One, you already know, it is teratogenic, and the other is it's liver toxic. So, you know, it's a bit of a balanced job here as to which would be the best drug. Clonazepam is not the best drug, although it's listed as a drug of choice. Clonazepam is usually too sedating. All right, and if you're sedating the patient, then that's not very appropriate when they're trying to sort of function on a day-to-day basis. One of the newer drugs, lamotrigine, has been approved for use in absence seizures. The trouble with lamotrigine is it causes quite marked hypersensitivity-based skin reactions in a small but significant percentage of children, and like 1 to 2%. And these can be life-threatening. It's not just like, oh, I've got a rash. This is life-threatening skin reactions. And so that's a limitation to lamotrigine, a newer drug. Myoclonus, no argument. At least we finally come down to one drug of choice. Myoclonic seizures, valproic acid. Backup, well, clonazepam, but it's very sedating, as I've said. Felbamate, maybe, but what does felbamate do? It causes liver damage and blood damage. We don't like that too much, actually. It was taken off the market in 1995 because of those side effects. It's back because sometimes you might need it. But clearly, you know, newer drugs, sometimes it takes a little while to sort out, you know, just where they're going to fit into the scheme of things. Status epilepticus, a continuous seizure disorder. Intravenous drugs are needed here. The usual drugs of choice, there's not an awful lot to choose between them, but most authorities now say that lorazepam would be perhaps first, or diazepam. There's not an awful distinction there. And then possibly phenytoin, or a water-soluble variant of that called fosphenytoin. And then maybe in a long-term application, perhaps phenobarbital. I know this is sort of rather difficult for people to remember all these intimate details about drugs of choice, but I'm suggesting that it might be worth it in this instance, because of history tells us that people have been interested in you knowing this information. Now, I need you to know also some specific information about individual drugs. Phenytoin, if I may use my term once again, top 10, where I've told you that there are a listing of drugs that come up very, very frequently. Phenytoin is on that list. So you already know something about phenytoin. We said that its mechanism of action is as a sodium channel blocker. That's fairly straightforward. You might know that phenytoin is also an antiarrhythmic. It's a type 1B drug, similar to lidocaine. And you may not know this, but it is a drug that we now consider to be a backup drug in bipolar affective disorder. The main drug we think of for manic depressive disorder is lithium, but if you can't use lithium or it doesn't work well, then you may consider phenytoin in that regard. The features that make this drug a top 10 drug actually not only include, you know, what its mechanism is or what it's used for, but an awful lot of interest in both its biodisposition and also its side effect profile. This drug is very variable in its oral absorption. For example, if a group of patients, say 100 patients, took the same dose of phenytoin orally, you would find as much as a 20-fold variation in plasma level, which is really very, very variable oral absorption. In addition, the drug undergoes first-pass metabolism. It binds extensively to plasma proteins, particularly albumin, and sometimes can displace other drugs, and it itself can be displaced by drugs. And remember, if you increase the free fraction of a drug, you tend to enhance its pharmacological actions. It's an inducer of cytochrome P450 in our liver, and that can lead to drug interactions. All of these properties, you see, really make the drug sort of interesting. Now, under the adverse effect category, I'd like you to recognize that phenytoin does have CNS depressant properties. It's a sedator, and it may cause in some patients, you know, visual dysfunction, double vision, or perhaps even in some patients, ataxia. Of course, there's a lot of acne. If you're prone to acne, it seems to be exacerbated by the use of the drug phenytoin. It also causes growth of one's gum tissue, gingiva. And so gingival hyperplasia or gingival overgrowths are not uncommon with phenytoin, sometimes to the point that you actually have the gums going over the incisors, which is really, it's not just a cosmetic matter, it's more than that. But that's a rather unusual property, but it's associated with phenytoin. Likewise, hirsutism. Excessive hair, usually where you don't want it, actually. Osteomalacia can occur, and that's another feature that's rather characteristic of phenytoin. And it is hematotoxic, although not to the extent of carbamazepine, as you'll see in a moment. Teratogenesis, yes. Don't use in pregnancy because of the fetal hydantoin syndrome that often presents as structural abnormalities, craniofacial, including cleft palate and cleft lip. So this one is out when it comes to pregnancy. Carbamazepine, you might know it as Tegretol, has a mechanism similar to phenytoin. It's got also some other properties that I want you to recall. It's the drug of choice for trigeminal neuralgia, a very painful condition, and I would say that there isn't any drug better than carbamazepine in most patients in that regard. Like phenytoin, it can be used as a backup drug to lithium in bipolar affective disorder. Like phenytoin, it's an inducer of P450, so can actually cause drug interactions by that mechanism. Happens to increase its own metabolism by virtue of inducing an enzyme that metabolizes it. So actually that also impacts on dosing considerations. It's a downer in the sense of sedation or ataxia or double vision, etc. Like phenytoin, causes osteomalacia. Like phenytoin, causes hematotoxicity, except it's worse. The granulocytopenia is fairly common, but the anemia, particularly the aplastic anemia, though not common, is not easily reversible. You get water retention because you promote the formation and secretion of antidiuretic hormone, and in some patients we've seen quite marked skin reactions, exfoliative dermatitis, for example. Teratogenicity, mainly craniofacial abnormalities. There's been recent reports of spina bifida occurring with carbamazepine, but if you were to choose which of the anticonvulsants causes spina bifida, I'm hoping you will choose valproic acid. Valproate has lots of actions. I mean, it's a blocker of T-type calcium channels in the thalamus. It inhibits the enzyme GABA transaminase. And what would that do? That should increase GABA levels, shouldn't it? It also happens to block sodium channels in axons. So we're really not quite sure, you know, which fits with which particular seizure disorder. Suffice it to say, we've already described that valproic acid can be used for most seizure disorders. And if you were put into a position of having to say, which drug could I use for any seizure disorder, it would probably be valproic acid, right? The only consideration I would have there was that you're probably not going to use valproate for status epilepticus, but you could use it for pretty much anything else. It's a backup in bipolar disorder. That's a useful property. It's also used in migraine, as are many drugs, which tells us, of course, that we don't have any really selective drugs for migraine that we can guarantee will work. It's an inhibitor of P450. Remember, we just said that carbamazepine and phenytoin are inducers. Well, this drug inhibits metabolism of other drugs, in fact, including the metabolism of phenytoin and carbamazepine. The primary adverse effect, I would say, is going to concern the GI tract, and in fact, liver toxicity is the crucial issue here. There is a dose-dependent formation of a potentially toxic metabolite which binds to the hepatocyte and ultimately leads to a necrosis of the liver. The centrilobular necrosis, meaning, of course, that you haven't got a liver. And this means, of course, that you either get a new one or you don't survive. Now, that's a very unfortunate thing, especially since when valproic acid, when first introduced into medicine, was introduced with only one indication, absence seizures. And absence seizures are things that we think of in children and youngsters. And basically, a large number of kids were overdosed, and that meant that they lost their livers. We also see evidence of pancreatitis with valproic acid. There are a number of drugs that we associate with pancreatitis. Here's one of them for you. You lose your hair, alopecia, and you may see evidence of, when exposed to UV light, of very marked skin reactions that represent sensitivity to UV light. This is a teratogen, not to be used in pregnancy. This is your drug that causes neural tube defects, spina bifida. And I can't imagine one that would be more likely to do that that is commonly used. There are other drugs that do that. And of course, spina bifida is associated with folate deficiency. Ethosuximide is the fourth of the drugs that I formally want to say a few words about. What have we had? We've had phenytoin, carbamazepine, and valproic acid. Ethosuximide, we think, blocks the T-type calcium channels in the thalamus. It has only one use, and that would be absence seizures. Its biggest problem is gastrointestinal distress, and that's usually been the reason why you might consider valproic acid perhaps as a first-choice drug. Current diagnosis and treatment of 2000 suggests that perhaps you start with valproic acid, but it's largely based on side effect rather than efficacy. Other things that you might consider would be lethargy or fatigue. Again, you may have evidence of skin reactions or dermatitis, and there's even been a few reports of dysfunction of the extrapyramidal system that's been seen with ethosuximide. But overall, at least it doesn't have teratogenic potential. At least it's safe in pregnancy, and we do like that feature of it, although, as I say, it's mainly used for younger people, often many of them not in the category of pregnancy. Barbiturates and benzodiazepines you already know an awful lot about. I want you to pick out phenobarb as the dominant barbiturate used as an anti-seizure drug, and that would certainly be important. And pick out clonazepam as a rather specific benzodiazepine that's had a long history as an anticonvulsant drug. It doesn't have that many uses. And it usually is considered second to other drugs because of its marked sedative properties, but would be a drug in absence seizures or in myoclonus as a possibility. Recently, we've been seeing clonazepam actually having efficacy as an anti-anxiety drug, so you might want to sort of keep that at your back of your mind. It is, after all, a benzodiazepine. So is lorazepam and diazepam, and I emphasize lorazepam for you here because a fairly recent consensus of neurologists suggested that lorazepam might be the first drug to consider intravenously in the management of status epilepticus. Neuroanticonvulsants, one of the most surprising things, I think, to us in pharmacology over the past 5 or 6 years has been that we have doubled the number of anticonvulsant drugs that we now have available for treatment of seizure disorders. The first drug to be introduced was in 1994. That was felbamate. It was taken off in 1995 because of hemato and hepatotoxicity, but it came back again as an adjunctive drug. This has been followed by four or five other drugs. Gabapentin. Well, that one should be easy for us. We could say, well, gabapentin probably works like GABA. It certainly works to help out GABA, and that's true. And it is useful in partial seizures, no argument about that. But notice that gabapentin has been expanding its clinical utility since it got in. One of its useful properties is pain of neuropathic origin. Now, what am I talking about here? Pain that occurs in the diabetic patient because of damage to the neurons. Pain that occurs in the HIV patient because of treatment of drugs like AZT, which actually cause damage and severe pain. So these are indications that are improvements on the role of gabapentin in medicine. Likewise, it's a drug that seems to be valuable in bipolar disorder, and it's even being used in migraine. So there's more to gabapentin than meets the eye. I mentioned to you earlier that lamotrigine actually causes very severe skin reactions. They resemble the Stevens-Johnson syndrome, and since lamotrigine was initially approved for use in absence seizure, it was children that really had these severe reactions. The other drugs that you see here, I would just say to you that if you want more details about them, I did put something together in a little tabular form, and that will be in the text, all right? General features of anticonvulsants. First, think about additive CNS depression. Certainly that would occur with antihistamines, ethanol, sedative hypnotics, and opioids. You should be careful not to abruptly withdraw the patient from use of anticonvulsants, because you can precipitate a seizure state. That's an important consideration. You should taper dose and warn them not to take it into their own heads to stop taking a drug. That may put them into a severe seizure. And anticonvulsant drugs are commonly drugs that interfere with the activity of oral contraceptives. I think we can understand how some of them do that, like for example, phenytoin or carbamazepine and phenobarbital or any barbiturate, because you see they increase the activity of drug metabolizing enzymes, and oral contraceptives are drugs. You know, they're estrogens and progestins, and they need to be metabolized. And if you metabolize them more rapidly, their effectiveness may be reduced. So it's usually a good idea in patients who are being treated with anticonvulsants to convince that patient to use other modes of contraception. They don't have to stop taking the oral contraceptive, but they should also have some backup there in that regard.